a good day, and we have good news.
This new tax reform plan that's just been unveiled by the Finance Committee, this is really exciting because it's an opportunity, after a lot of talk over a lot of years, to finally fix our tax code.
We plan for lower rates. As you've heard, we increase the standard deduction, we expand the child tax credit, and we reform the tax code so we give Americans access to more job and higher wages.
The centerpiece of the legislation is where it ought to be, in the center of our population, middle-class America.
Workers in America, including my home state of Ohio, are competing with one hand tied behind their back.
Today is America's lucky day.
Today is a good day.
This is a terrific opportunity. This is a very big day. It's a big step forward on our path to restoring the economic growth that we've been waiting for all this time.
And our objective is to get this to the president to sign in December.
I'm excited about this. Let's move forward.
Working paycheck to paycheck, year in and year out, praying and hoping for something good to happen. Today is good news.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, we have a negative week for stocks this week as stocks plunged on Thursday and a bit on Friday. The market not liking the news. Corporate tax cuts may be delayed by a year. And we got another version of the GOP tax plan this week coming from the Senate. And the market didn't like it at all. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in the first hour, Frank Barbera will be joining me. He says this stock market is getting a little bit extended in price, a possible short-term top, but the FANG stocks continue to surge. You want to hear what he says and why Frank thinks gold could be a sleeper. Also later on, Robert Rapier will be joining me, and he believes oil is at a tipping point. Remember the last time we had Robert on the program, he talked about $60 oil by year end. Here we are on this Friday with $57 oil, and he also thinks the fear cycle is returning to the oil markets. All of that coming up in hour one.
And I'm John Loeffler. Indeed, the Dow took a 250-point hit on news that the Senate version of the tax bill would delay corporate tax cuts for 1 year. Senate's version is out, House version out. It's a work in progress, obviously. But what's the difference between the two? The important differences anyway. And what does that mean for you and me, who are all taxpayers here in the country? After all, we've lived for more than a half a century with all these deductions and exemptions, and now they're talking about changing all of that. Is it real tax reform or simply a shell game? That will be the subject of conversation on the first part of the Financial Sense News Hour. And then risky business. You know, we're living here in a world of low interest rates, the lowest in history. Makes it hard for you when you're saving. Remember, just a few years ago, we could get some pretty safe investments yielding 8%, 5%. Even as late as 2007, but that's not the case anymore. The only place you can do that is having yields in junk bonds. And the question is that really where you want to stay? It's risky business, and you have to know when to get out. All of that conversation today on The Big Picture is part of the Financial Sense News Hour. And as we always do for the market wrap every week, normally we hear from Ryan Poplava, but sitting in for him is Chris Sheridan, host of the weekly program FS Insider. Lots of things going on. The market took a little dip, I think, after the announcement that perhaps corporate tax cuts would be delayed a year. That was in the Senate budget, but whatever else is going on.
Yeah, John, that's correct. The Dow and the S&P 500 finally broke an 8-week winning streak this week after, as you noted, the Senate released their version of the tax bill, saying that they wanted a number of key changes, one of which being the delay in the cut to corporate taxes by a year. As you and many of our listeners know, there has been a lot of anticipation built into that cut. If it happens, and that's going to be a direct benefit to corporate earnings. So any delay in that obviously puts a little bit of an extra headwind and uncertainty into the corporate outlook. So that was the main reason that was cited for why we saw a drop really on Thursday. One thing that has been raising a bit of attention lately has been the junk bond market. So more and more people are pointing out to weakness that we've seen in junk bonds, the high yield space. There's been a divergence between the stock market and high yield. So that's a bit of a watch point that I think we all need to have on our radar. There was a recent article by Wall Street Journal talking about this, really noting the fact that investors typically look to junk bonds as an early warning sign of broader market hiccups. So if we continue to see weakness in the junk bond space, I would say that could be a sign of trouble for the broader stock market. So that's one thing to keep your eye on. Looking past the stock market, oil also posted its fifth straight weekly gain. A lot of that around news headlines in Saudi Arabia, with the detaining of 201 individuals, including princes, businessmen, and government officials after a three-year investigation, alleging that an estimated $100 billion of state funds have been embezzled. So that is the news from MarketWatch talking about what's going on in there. And an analyst at UBS Wealth Management, they quote, says that Saudi Arabia is the second largest crude producer after Russia. It's the largest exporter, and it's the country with the largest spare capacity. So really anything that's going on in Saudi Arabia, any uncertainties regarding their production is starting to price in a risk premium to the oil markets. And again, Robert Rapier will have more to talk about that later. Speaking of gains, Bitcoin as well hit a new all-time high this week on Wednesday, just below $7,900. And it's interesting because when it comes to Bitcoin, we spoke with Avi Gilbert also on Wednesday, and he said that they have had a price target for Bitcoin between $7,500 and $8,000 now for quite some time. And now that we've reached that target, they're expecting a major drop in the cryptocurrency. And as many of you probably know, there's been a lot of talk about it being in a bubble. It's interesting. That was a very timely interview because right after we aired that, Bitcoin proceeded to drop over $1,000 in a 48-hour time period. So I'm not going to say he called the top because we don't know if this is the beginning of a much longer prolonged correction or if this was more of a short-term thing in nature. But so far, at least as far as this week's events go with Bitcoin, Avi Gilbert's comments couldn't have been more timely. And lastly, CoreLogic came out with a report this week on home prices, noting that home prices have surged 7% year over year from September 2016 to September 2017. And they actually noted that nearly half of the nation's largest 50 metros are now in the overvalued category. And CoreLogic also notes that they don't expect this level of price appreciation to continue moving into September of 2018, saying that they expect a price appreciation of just under 5% versus the 7% that we saw a year ago from this period. And the last note I want to make is we did see a data point come out this week with U.S. consumer sentiment falling from a 13-year high. Richard Curtin, the director of the University of Michigan Consumer Survey, says that while the majority judge current conditions in the economy favorably and consumers anticipated continued growth on balance, consumers judged the outlook less satisfactory and were equally divided about whether the expansion that's in the economy that we've seen since 2009 would last another 5 years. So slight moderation among many of you out there, consumers, on the outlook. Not a huge drop, but certainly a pullback from the 13-year high that we saw in the last month.
Chris, are there any interviews that you or Jim have done for the weekly FS Insider interviews that are really worthy of highlighting that you'd like people to hear?
Well, yeah, we've had a number of pretty big name guests over the last several weeks. So Jim Paulson, we spoke to at the Leuthold Group. He used to be at Wells Fargo. That was a excellent interview talking about tax reform and why he thought it was not coming at the right time in this cycle. We also had an interview with Gary Schilling on why he's doubling down on deflation. And then the two most recent ones have been with Felix Zuloff, the legendary fund manager out of Switzerland. We spoke with him about the market melt-up, his concerns about China, and a lot of other areas. And then lastly, Russell Napier just aired this week on Friday. So those are a number of some pretty big name guests we had. As I mentioned, Avi Gilbert also on Wednesday saying that Bitcoin was setting up for a major drop. He also gave his outlook on the metals complex, on the stock market as well. And then next week, we're actually going to have a number of really interesting interviews as well. Jim is going to be speaking with Scott Galloway, author of The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. You're not going to want to miss that interview with him next week. Also, we're going to be speaking with Woody Purcell at 13D Research. And this is going to be a really outside-of-the-box interview, because we're going to touch upon things that probably a lot of you don't know unless you've been doing some hardcore investigation into these areas. We're going to talk about the twin arms race that's taking place both in quantum computing and with artificial intelligence, how those two are related, and how we see that playing out, not just with corporations like Google, IBM, Intel, Alibaba, but also with militaries, China, Russia, the US. So that's going to be a really eye-opening interview. If you're not aware of some of this information, definitely want to encourage all of you to tune in for those interviews. And again, if you are not a subscriber, it's very easy to do so. You can just go to financialsense.com, click the subscribe banner at the top, and you can sign up for a month or a year. And there's even a free trial option as well.
All right, Chris Sheridan, thank you for sitting in today for Ryan Poplava. Financial Sense NewsHour continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense NewsHour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
I believe the market is heading up to the 2800 to 2880 region as our next big target. I remember when I said back in late 2015, I said that our next big target in the market is going to be 2537 to 2611. And most people thought I was crazy. Well, here I think people will adopt it a little more because bullish sentiment has significantly increased over this period of time.
Well, the stock market seems unstoppable almost every single week. We're hitting new records. We are doing this interview on a Thursday where we got a bit of a little downturn over concerns that the tax bill, or at least the corporate tax cuts, may be postponed for a whole year. Joining us on the program from the Gold Stock Technician is Frank Barbera. And Frank, let's begin with the market, because this thing has almost been unstoppable since November 8th of last year.
That's right, Jim, and good afternoon. We have seen just a truly relentless one-sided move. I know it's something a lot of people did not foresee. I know I certainly have been surprised at the unrelenting nature, almost the total absence of downside volatility. Of course, the day we're talking, the market had a little bit of a dip, but compared to what we've seen in the past, the volatility level, the downside behavior has been very, very small. From my standpoint of view, I see a couple of things that are sort of glaring. First, the market is extended in price, but you do have to respect the fact that when you look at the long-term trend going back to 2009, it's pretty clear that we've seen a big five-wave sequence developing over the last 8 years. And if you were to connect some of the highs in July of 2009 across some of the highs in early 2014, you get a big parallel channel, and the market seems to be moving up to try and reach for that channel in what looks like a pretty obvious fifth wave type pattern. That's interesting because fifth waves can blow off and move briefly outside and above the upper end of a parallel channel, and that's pretty dramatic behavior. In the case of the current S&P, if it wanted to do something like that, it could actually reach towards 2950 to 3000 over the next 2 to 3 months, and that would be a sort of a dramatic grand finale. Now, of course, the other side of that trade would be probably a really serious washout and more likely a major trend reversal. I think that major trend reversal is kind of coming either way. It's just a question of how soon and when. Right now, 2580 to 2600 area, the market's beginning to look like it could be stalling. And so I'm not so sure that we don't just fade right here and make a top over the next week or so and then begin to pull back. It does look like we could be heading for a correction in the not too distant future, because the number of net new highs has been coming off. Internally, advanced decline has been weakening. We do have excess sentiment. And usually that combination of weakening internals, weakening leadership, and highly one-sided sentiment can be a setup for potential correction.
One of the things that has characterized the market this year, there hasn't even been as much as a 3% pullback or correction. And even heading into, you know, coming off summer, usually September, October, if there's going to be a serious correction or one of any significance, you see it around that time of this year. Has that surprised you that we have not seen that, that it has basically been, what did we get, a 2% correction?
So far, the worst drawdown that we've seen this year has been 2.9%. And believe it or not, Jim, that is the lowest drawdown, the shallowest drawdown of any year that we have seen since 1914. So you really have to go back actually over 100 years to see a year like this. So if it feels strange and seems strange, just know that it is strange. You know, people who have read my work over many years know I like to track time spans, which are these long intervals. So sometimes what I'll do, I'll say to the computer, how long has it been since the market has gone from the upper 50-day Bollinger Band to the lower 50-day Bollinger Band? When's the last time we tagged the 50-day Bollinger Band? Right now, that streak's at an all-time record. The last time the 30-week moving average had a downturn from 1 week to another, that's at an all-time record. We're also really rapidly closing in on the longest bull market ever, using any stock market in world history in terms of the number of weeks, 9 years. Bull markets just don't last much more than usually 6 to 7 years. That's extreme. So we're pushing into, you know, 8+ and challenging 9. And this is a point in time where you have to be really careful about late cycle dynamics. I mean, it's vertical. It's moving up in a very extended fashion. That's not to say it has to turn down. It's still holding on a short-term basis above every trend line, above every moving average. And what I've seen in the last 2 weeks is that the very narrow leadership, which has been carrying the market, the FANG stocks, Apple, Amazon, Google, Facebook, all of these stocks have sort of reignited in a, what looks like an even more dramatic and potentially climactic surge, where they're moving straight up on a long-term linear chart. On a very short-term basis, there's, to this point in time as we're talking, there hasn't been any sign of really a chink in the armor on those stocks. I mean, they're all really respecting short-term support, short-term moving averages, momentum behind them is high. And so that tells me that the true leadership, the leadership that counts, has not gone through something that looks like enough of a break to really take the starch out of the bull market. So this feels like something where we might be getting close, you know, maybe not right now, but as we get closer to Thanksgiving, a 3 to 5% pullback. And then I'd say the odds are pretty high that even if we get that, that we get some kind of a residual rally back up to test the highs. What listeners should understand is that markets tend to make W-type bottoms and M-tops. And when you have a market that's trending up and gets very overbought and very extended, that could be the left side of an M. And then you have a correction that unfolds over a number of weeks and has a drawdown. It takes momentum down off those very high levels. That's the middle of the M, but usually you get, you know, 9 times out of 10, you get a retest or a token new high, and you get a residual, what I call an echo rally. And once you get that rally and then things start to falter, at that stage of the game, you might be looking at something more lasting, more permanent in the way of a trend change in the major trend. But right now, we just haven't seen enough technical damage to the stock market to suggest that, you know, that there's a really big change at hand. It's been amazing. I've been amazed at the fact that so little has actually happened in terms of legislation being passed. I mean, now we're looking at tax reform, and that seems to be getting stalled once again. And yet the market has taken it all so far in very good stride.
You know, something that somebody once mentioned to me on this show, Frank, is that one reason the volatility or the VIX index is down is so much of what occurs in the market each day is algo trading, and so much of the inflows into the market is coming from passive index funds. So, you know, computers have no emotions.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it almost feels like, this isn't a perfect analogy, but when you bring that point up, it almost feels like a market that's kind of being cornered, like a commodity market. Remember the 1980s, the Hunt brothers tried to corner the silver market, and silver just continued to move up relentlessly over time, and then it finally spiked and then crashed. And the way this market is being driven, it's being driven by these massive passive flows that are really centering into, as you pointed out so eloquently in the past, into a handful of big Wall Street firms, the Fidelities, the BlackRock, the Schwabs, the TDs, the Morgan Stanleys, et cetera. And if those firms, the Vanguard, if they're not going to sell, then, you know, it kind of means that a lot of the potential float that's out there available to push, potentially act as a weight on pushing prices down, that's just basically locked up. And maybe what we're really dealing with is a market where the percentage of the float that's really being traded is pretty small. Does that make any sense?
It does, because you have this concentration. Over 50% of the nation's wealth is in just five institutions, and four institutions when it comes to who controls the index funds. So, I mean, you and I have discussed this in the past. If you're going to sell, who do you sell to? I mean, if you got four guys in the room that control all the index funds, and all of a sudden they get, I don't know, liquidation notices from investors, it almost strikes me, Frank, that you could almost see kind of like what we saw in the flash crash back in 2010. I can remember Procter & Gamble dropped like $40, $50 a share because there weren't any buyers. So could we see something like that again?
You know, I think that's really possible. I wouldn't predict it right now, but I think when the time comes, when this market finally does lose enough momentum to really begin turning down, once we've seen some pullbacks, that you've got to see some of these big stocks literally breaking some key support levels, and that just hasn't happened. That restart that we saw on earnings a few weeks ago when Amazon was up $130, the big move up in Apple, it's really rekindled a lot of momentum in the tank. And right now, that's providing a lot of rear guard action. I mean, you do see a lot of stocks moving down. I've watched the tape constantly, seen things, you know, Domino's breaking down, a lot of retail stocks moving down. So it has the REITs have been under pressure. But still, with all of that, the averages have been held up in what seems to be almost a perpetual rotation, which is something I've actually never seen to this degree since I've been following the stock market. And I started following the stock market in the late 1970s. So this is really a one-off in my career. And it's a strange market. It's a market that does seem like something different is at work, that something different has been at work. And I think it's this excess blow-off in passive investing. You know, if and when something finally changes that and breaks crowd psychology, which, you know, the one thing sort of history really says is that psychological pendulum eventually swings. We may be on a two sigma type excursion on the pendulum to one side right now, and maybe it's lingering there a long time, but eventually it tends to swing back the other way. And when it does, I think, to your point, it'll just be that much more severe. I think for a lot of investors, the real key has to be, you know, if you're putting new money in the stock market, what's the right allocation for this point in time? And the easy temptation is to say, you know, the market's been red hot, go big into stocks, you know, have a high allocation to equities. That's probably conventional wisdom. I would say because it's been so long that it's been moving up, you should actually be allocating less and then waiting to see if we do have a decent sized correction or some kind of meaningful downturn. I think there are some real fundamental issues that could be out there. I mean, the tax reform looks like it's getting really bogged down. And I mean, I don't know if you heard this today, but they're talking about attaching the repeal of Obamacare into the tax reform bill. And when I heard that, I couldn't help but agree with one of the senators who said, yeah, this is a great idea. We're going to take something that hasn't worked all year long and now attach it into the one piece of legislation that we absolutely have to get done. Great idea. You know, so that just doesn't seem very smart. And then I think also this trip that Trump is making through the Far East, I think part of it is to deal with trade, but I also think a big part of that is North Korea. And I think one thing he's unlikely to do is to let the North Korean situation fester that much longer. So I think North Korea may be something that's really heating up on the front burner come December and early next year. And so that could be another issue that could at some point potentially become a meaningfully enough issue to hurt the equity market.
So, Frank, let's talk about a couple other markets. I want to go to interest rates. It's widely expected the Fed will raise interest rates next month. And at the beginning of the year, they thought the markets, at least interest rates, we would be at 3% on the 10-year right now. We seem to be caught in this sort of narrow trading range going from about 2.5 down to maybe 2.1%, not doing much of any. My own opinion, a lot of that is a reflection of yields in Europe and Japan, which in many places are negative. So, I mean, U.S. Treasuries at a 2.3% looks like a junk bond. But what's your take on interest rates? And then finally, I want to touch on gold.
Sure. I mean, interest rates, I have to say right now, I'm fairly unabashed bond bull. I think there are some really good areas in the bond market for people who are just interested in earning a reasonable return to deploy capital. The intermediate high-grade corporate space, in other words, high quality, looks good. I like Treasury. To me, the 10-year's at about 233 right now, Jim. It's short-term, it looks like it could back up one more time towards 239, 240. So there might be 6 or 7 basis points on the upside in the really short term. But I think if the equity market starts to struggle, the basic path for yields is still down. And I would maybe change that opinion if we saw a move through 260 on the 10-year yield. I think if we broke through those highs, the highs that we saw way back in December of 2016, and then again in March of this year, essentially mid-March of this year, right up around 260, 262, if we went through those highs, then I'd say, okay, especially if they pass some kind of comprehensive tax reform that looked like it might stimulate the economy a lot. My view on the economy is it's just, you know, I know unemployment is near record lows. I know insurance claims, initial claims for unemployment have not moved up. But basically, you really have a wage issue where there is not any wage inflation. We're creating a lot of low-quality jobs in the economy, and that's distorting some of these statistics that make it sound better than it really is. And I think the bond market is seeing that. It's seeing essentially that the real trend globally is flat economic growth, very choppy, uneven economic growth. I would describe it as shaky. And ultimately, if there is a reversal in equities, I think there's a serious risk brewing out there that we could see a major hit on the wealth effect of stocks right now in terms of their total market valuation. The market cap of the equity market is huge relative to the size of the global economy. It's at its biggest level. So the impact of a 10% decline in the stock market or a 20% decline in the stock market, we've had essentially a huge inflation in wealth. And if that were to turn down suddenly, the result could easily be a bust and a period of deflation that would actually take hold. And I think yields could ultimately move back down towards that 1.4, 1.5% area on the 10-year treasury. And that may take a year, year and a half to get there, but I would not be surprised to see treasury yields fall. One reason for that is just that the dollar is stable, at least it's reasonably stable right now. And compared to bond yields anywhere else in the world, our bonds look like a reasonably attractive yield. And there's a chart they had on the internet just recently of European high yield bonds. And those yields have come all the way down to match treasury yields for the first time ever. So the essentially the European junk to treasury spread is at zero, and that's mind-boggling. Even our treasury junk spread is down to, I think it was about 357 this week, and the lows of the last few years have been right around 336, 340. So you look at these bond spreads, and it implies where I see issues right now is in the junk market, in emerging market debt. The last couple of days, we've actually seen a pretty material break in the high yield market and in the EMD market. And that's an interesting, potentially a leading indicator for the stock market, because those risk-on bonds, junk bonds, usually tend to turn down before an important peak in the stock market. So that's another little tidbit I can throw out and share as if something that's suggesting maybe the market's getting close to a correction. But boy, it has been amazing so far.
And finally, Frank, your take on gold here. It's up for the year, but it seems to kind of like treasury bonds. It goes back and forth, although, you know, it's a positive year for gold investors, which is better than previous years.
You know, I think gold could be a sleeper. I'm being careful with it. The physical metal to me looks like it's building a very, very solid base right about at the 1255, 1260 area. So I think as long as gold can hold, call it 1255 on the spot market, we're at about 1286 right now. That gives it a little bit of room. I think there's a good shot, especially if it moves to 1304, which is the high that we saw on gold back on October 16th. The next stop would be 1330, then maybe 1350, 1360. If it ever blows through 1360, which is the key high, going back over the last 2 years, I think then you're in a very strong bull market move that could move up dramatically. On the downside, a move below 1255 would probably take us down to 1200 one more time. But all in all, I think gold is, it looks quiet, it looks sleepy, it's pretty oversold. They're starting to see some positive divergences. And I think if it picks up a little bit, it could get really interesting in a hurry. So I'm very attracted to the gold market right now. I think it's low risk, it's out of favor. And when you look at the mining stocks, you know, they have to, they're very volatile. And as always, we track them a lot in the newsletter. You have to have an exit point on all of the mining stocks, but they also look potentially really cheap and interesting. So I think that's an area that could be really productive over the next few months.
Well, listen, Frank, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out about the Gold Stock Technician, tell them how they could do so, please.
They can just send an email to me at frankbgst, that's Frank, B as in Barbera, GST at AOL.com, and we'll add them to the list.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at financialsense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining me on the program from the San Diego Office of Social Security is Yolanda York. And Yolanda, why don't we begin and talk about Medicare enrollment, some of the rules, why it's important to get it done when you're supposed to, because you don't want to end up paying higher premiums. So let's begin with that, if we could.
Well, it's very simple. If you are going to be 65, you need to apply for Medicare 3 months before you become 65, so we can get you on our records for the Part A, which covers hospital, Part B that covers 80% of your doctor bills. And you need to apply 3 months before you become 65, and you can file online. All it takes is 12 minutes to apply for the Medicare Part A and B. If you are receiving Social Security benefits now, let's say you started collecting them at an early age, we have you on our record. So that means we will automatically send you that Medicare card 2 months before you become 65, so you won't really have to do anything.
Well, here we are on this Friday with oil prices standing firm at around $57 a barrel. Several of our experts said that they could see $60 oil by the end of the year. Well, we're not too far away. Joining us on the program is Robert Rapier. Robert, let's talk about the price of oil here. What's driving it? We've had a nice run-up since the lows of mid-June, and there were a lot of individuals that thought we'd be heading right back down to 50, but here we are closer to 60, which is your forecast.
Right. Over the history of the oil industry has cycled between, you know, fear and complacency. And a decade ago, for instance, the peak oil narrative helped drive oil prices. People were afraid that oil was going to be scarce. And so any negative news pushed the price of oil higher. Any geopolitical event in Nigeria, in Libya, those all pushed the price of oil higher. And ultimately, that ushered in the shale oil revolution, and we ended up with too much oil. Oil supply outstripped demand, and then we shifted into this cycle of complacency. And we've been in that cycle for the past 3 years or so. And in that cycle, any bullish news, any news that indicates less supply or stronger demand, it doesn't really affect oil prices. We saw that several times this year. We saw a particularly large draw on oil inventories that just didn't really move oil prices. But eventually you get to that tipping point, and I think we are at the tipping point now where enough people realize, okay, the trends are headed in the direction of scarcity again, and that means the fear cycle could be returning. And suddenly I think the market remembers how important Saudi Arabia is to the world's oil balance. And so you've got events over there that are suddenly getting the attention of people. And I think that's what's happening. We're starting to come out of the cycle of complacency as we see that global inventories are coming down. Demand is continuing to grow strongly. And I think that's what's happened.
Yeah, you know, it's rather interesting, Robert, because in the last couple of years when we had the oil glut and there were inventory stacked up and storage on tankers, any geopolitical event was ignored. And I think the reason it was ignored is people weren't worried because there was plenty of oil inventory around to handle any disruptions that would happen politically. But now that these storage levels are coming down, supply and demand balance is coming into play. Let's talk about what's going on in Saudi Arabia and the implications, major shakeup. We haven't seen anything like this, and I can't remember, at least in my working career, when we've seen anything like this.
Right, and you know, it's uncertain how this is all going to end up. I read an article this morning that thought that war with Iran was more likely, and if that were to happen, then you'd see oil prices go significantly higher. I've seen some people say that, you know, this prince is aligned with Trump and is going to bump up the oil production there and make sure the oil is well supplied. I've seen that argument as well, make sure the market is well supplied with oil. But I think the whole instability in the area and the whole concern, I mean, they've made some noise toward Iran now. That makes the markets very nervous. And a year ago, this probably wouldn't have moved the markets much because, as you say, the inventories were still quite high. People weren't concerned about it. Now they're looking ahead and they're saying, you know, inventories are coming down. And if we have any disruption in Saudi Arabia and Iran, we could run into a problem pretty quickly.
Does he run the risk, however, when you start arresting members of the royal family like he has and some very powerful princes, that you have internal conflicts that can make the kingdom less stable?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a key concern. And any civil unrest within Saudi Arabia, I mean, Saudi Arabia, make no mistake, is the single most important oil-producing entity in the world. I mean, one company there produces about 10% of the world's oil. In the U.S., you know, we've got thousands of companies that produce about 10% of the world's oil, and it's spread across a wide geography. So, you know, geopolitical events in the U.S. or, you know, problems in the U.S. don't impact oil production like something going on in Saudi Arabia. I mean, anything going on in Saudi Arabia, and they rely on one field very heavily over there. So that makes the markets very nervous.
When you have something like this, and is really, if there was a conflict with, let's say, Iran, I'm not sure if Saudi Arabia has the military to take Iran on unless they were to have, let's say, U.S. backing. And wouldn't that end up in a full-scale conflagration?
It very well might, and I think you're probably right. I think Saudi would probably look to us for backing, and I think that we would probably give it to them. I think the administration right now is fairly hostile toward Iran, and I think a Saudi-Iran conflict, we'd clearly come down on the side of Saudi and would probably assist them.
What about the fact, Robert, if Iran doesn't do or tone down what it's doing, that the president reinstitutes, let's say, sanctions again, which would immediately remove 1 million barrels of oil from the market each day? I mean, that would do almost as much as the OPEC cuts themselves.
Yeah, correct. There are a lot of bullish factors, I think, that are still not reflected in the price of oil. There's a lot of risk factors that, again, you know, inventories are still on the high side, although they're trending down. But I think the market hasn't factored in, you know, the risks. And what that would mean is if any of these risks materialize, you'd see a very fast move in the price of oil. I saw an article this morning that someone sent me, and the headline was, "One young 33-year-old now controls the global price of oil." And I immediately thought, that's garbage. Nobody controls that much oil. And then I saw it's the Saudi prince. And I said, well, okay, well, yeah, that's true. I mean, he does. He really could have a tremendous influence on the global price of oil.
You know, it's amazing because when you looked at the shale revolution, when that came on, it was thought that OPEC was less relevant. What we're learning here, as we're seeing now, with political instability in Saudi Arabia, how much this market is impacted. Because from the announcement of that news, we went from almost $52 a barrel to where we are this Friday at $57 a barrel. So I guess maybe what we're seeing now is, with supply and demand coming into balance as we are right now, that the markets are more susceptible to any kind of geopolitical risk or disruption.
That's correct. And, you know, the people overstated, you know, what shale oil did was unexpected. You know, OPEC was not expecting the U.S. to add 5 million barrels of oil per day to the market. And it kind of caught them off guard. But, you know, they still produce 40% of the world's oil, OPEC does. And so to say OPEC is suddenly irrelevant is to really ignore, you know, it's just like suddenly somebody discovered a whole bunch of new oil and started dumping it on the market. That will affect the price, but that doesn't mean OPEC is irrelevant over the long term. It means they may lose control of the price of oil for a bit, which they did. And I think their bumps in production from 2014, when they declared a bid to regain market share, that was a miscalculation on their part. They were trying to get back their market share, which then they could control the price again. I think they should have just set firm and maybe just cut production a little bit. They did just the opposite. I called it a $1 trillion miscalculation on their part. I think now they've realized shale oil is a little more resilient than they thought. But in the long run, if they play their cards right, they still do control the world's oil markets. And a small group of people control the world's oil markets.
You know, something that really strikes me, though, and I want to get your views on this, and that is, a lot of experts have said that even though we're having some political instability, and of course, if it was a major conflict, you know, you could see oil prices back up over 70, 80, maybe even 100. But what about shale oil itself? We've seen the rig count come down when oil was weak during the beginning of the summer. But what happens if we get to 60, maybe 65, as some experts are calling for next year, and all of a sudden the drilling rigs pick up? And what happens if OPEC does not extend those cuts? And what happens then?
Yeah, I think if shale oil continues to rise, and I think it will rise into next year, I think the EIA is forecasting something like 700,000 barrels a day next year, which, according to their numbers, would put us breaking the all-time high record from 1970. I think that's going to happen. We're going to continue to creep higher. If OPEC doesn't extend their cuts, you know, I've seen some speculate. In fact, you know, one of the major banks speculated. It was actually Ed Morse at Citibank. He thinks OPEC is pumping as hard as they can. And there, I've seen several arguments to that effect. Now, if that's not true, and if OPEC does have production and they could dump it on the market, they could potentially crash the price again as inventory started to build. But I would ask, you know, what would be their motivation? They saw what happened last time that happened. It's going to simply cost them a lot of money, and I just don't think they're likely to go that course of action. They see oil prices going up. They would reason that their strategy is working, so I suspect they will continue along that strategy.
And don't they have a problem, Robert, with Russia? Because things I'm reading are saying Russian production is increasing, at least their exports are. So, you know, what if they can't control Russia? Isn't Russia the wild card here?
Yeah, Russia is important. I mean, it is important for them to have Russia on board with whatever they do. But I think even then, the IEA is forecasting 1.4 million barrels a day of demand growth next year. The U.S. is going to come in about 700,000 barrels a day. I don't know that Russia can make up the rest of that gap. And if the rest of OPEC, if OPEC stays firm, then, you know, I think the trends are still going to be down. I think the demand right now is higher than current supply, and that's why we're seeing the inventories come down. And so I have a hard time seeing, unless OPEC does simply throw in the towel and say, we're going to go back to allowing people to produce as much as they want, I just don't see oil prices crashing back down next year.
Let's talk about the industry itself. Two factors. We have this supply and demand balance coming into play. But one thing that I think the market sometimes forget, Robert, and we're seeing it, whether you're looking at EIA reports or IEA, is demand has been much stronger than originally anticipated, while, for example, shale production has been less than expected. So in the background, you have two things taking place. Increased demand as a result of global growth, especially overseas. And secondly, another factor nobody talks about is oil depletion. Shale wells deplete very quickly, and the older wells deplete every single year. That oil has to be replaced.
Correct. And, you know, if you knew when U.S. shale production would peak and start to decline, you could be a very wealthy person, because when that happens, we're going to see oil prices. You know, I've argued before that the only reason we don't have oil over $100 today is because of the shale boom. Had that not happened, had that oil not come online, and it started to really put a lot of new oil on the market about 2009, when we'd just seen oil go above $140 a barrel, had that not happened, we may be looking at $200 oil today.
You know, that's the one thing, because I often spoke with the late Matt Simmons, and we talked a lot about peak oil and, of course, Twilight in His Desert, which was his book. And then all of a sudden, horizontal drilling, fracking, and shale oil came into play, and here we are today. Who would have thought we would be talking about a glut over the last couple of years versus shortages?
Yeah, almost nobody, I can tell you that. I mean, I knew Matt Simmons as well, and I knew that he believed that there was no possible solution to an immediate oil decline. And that was very popular sentiment a decade ago. But, you know, I've told people, don't be too certain about the future. You always have to allow for things that you don't know about or don't understand. And that happened with shale oil. And I saw people belittle it when it started. And they said, yeah, this is going to amount to absolutely nothing, or it's uneconomic, or the energy cost is too high. And all those things turned out to be not true. You know, you can only downplay so long, a million barrels a day added year after year after year. And then, you know, suddenly you've put 5 million barrels of new oil onto the market. That's substantial. That's something.
Let's talk about something and relate this to investments now, because you have these major oil companies. I don't care if you're talking about Exxon, Chevron, Total, Royal Dutch. A lot of these companies had to cut back on their big exploration plays in order to preserve cash flow, because the price of oil, when it drops to 100 all the way down to 26, it's impacting your business. But a lot of these projects have been put on the back burner. In the meantime, these companies are still pumping out oil daily. What's going to happen down the road? Because another factor that's going to come in here is, if you're not replacing what you're producing, sooner or later, this is going to catch up with you down the road. I mean, what are these companies going to be doing, let's say, at the end of this decade?
Yeah, and that's exactly when those decisions to delay capital spending will hit. About, I've read about 2020 to 2022, there's going to be millions of barrels that did not come online because of those decisions to suspend or delay capital spending. You know, it just depends on what's demand like at that time. It does seem like we are going to, be short of the trajectory we were on, 3 years ago. You know, I've seen people forecast that there are 2 to 4 million barrels a day that will not come online as a result of the delays in capital spending. And that could have a significant impact in 2020, 2022. The problem is, you know, the electric vehicle narrative is still dominating and is still being pushed by the media that, you know, electric vehicles are going to make oil redundant. And that's going to be not happen, you know, as quickly as people think. And I think by 2020, it's going to be clear that oil demand continues to grow. I mean, we see that today in places like Norway that have had triple-digit electric vehicle growth for the last 7 years, in places like California where half the electric vehicles are. Those places have seen oil demand rise over the past few years. Now, you wonder, why is that happening? Well, it's happening because population continues to increase and so forth, and that trumps all of the increases in electric vehicles. And that's going to be the case globally for a number of years, that, yes, we will have explosive growth in electric vehicles, and, yes, oil demand will continue to grow. And that's overlooked by a lot of people. They just say, yeah, maybe we will have a shortfall, but electric vehicles are going to fill that gap. And I don't think that's true.
No, in fact, a lot of the automobile makers are really putting out hybrids where you have the battery and the electric or the gas engine. It was amazing because I often drive to Arizona and I have to climb a mountain, and I was climbing the mountain and you're trying to get up to 6,000 feet and I've got a Tesla, and you could just see after a while that Tesla began to fade back because, you know, you're burning up a lot of energy when you're climbing a 6,000 foot hill or mountain in that case. And that's the problem that you have with electric vehicles. Now, I don't think the technology has gotten to the point, or at least we don't have the infrastructure with charging stations where you make long distance travel real easy.
That's correct. I mean, the town that I live in, I won't mention the name of the company, but it is the test site of a fleet of these self-driving vehicles. And I've seen many people argue that the self-driving and electric vehicle combination is really what's going to drive down oil consumption. And more than once, I've seen one of these vehicles sitting outside, you know, a store or a restaurant, just idling its engine to recharge the batteries, because they can't run around all day long and not deplete those batteries. And so people don't realize this, you know, they are still consuming fossil fuels. These are not fully electric vehicles. They are hybrids, and those hybrids cannot run around all day on a charge. So, you know, yes, the hybrids will continue to increase. I mean, we've had explosive hybrid growth for more than a decade, and yet our oil consumption continued to rise. So, you know, there are more variables in this equation than people think. You know, more electric vehicles do not translate into lower oil demand. I mean, eventually it might if they continue to grow at the rate that they're growing, but it's much further out than people think. And because of the other variables in that equation, you know, globally, people moving into the middle class, buying cars, driving more miles, population growing, all those things have to be taken into account, and they frequently aren't.
You know, Robert, what is it about the energy industry from its genesis back in the 1900s? It always seems like it has been a boom and bust business. It was that way in the 19th century, likewise in the 20th century and the 21st century.
Well, it's just, you know, when prices get high, everybody forgets. And the problem is you have thousands of individual companies making individual decisions that they see in their own economic best interest. So even if you have some, you know, forward-thinking companies that go, okay, $100 oil is not going to last, we need to preserve our capital, you've got enough of them that go, wow, $100 oil, we're going to spend every bit of cash flow we have in reinvesting in more oil. And enough companies do that that, you know, after a while at $100 oil, you suddenly got too much production because everybody went out and spent, you know, every penny they could. And then the opposite happens, you know, prices crash and everybody, you know, nobody wants to spend any money. And so you have to catch up again. The demand has to catch back up to supply. And that's why the cycles happen. That's why they've always happened.
So given where we are today, if you had to put money in the energy sector, would you put it in the large cap, the mid tiers, the exploration companies, oil service companies? What sector looks good to you right now, given where oil is?
So I think that, oilfield services and the smaller oil companies will do very well right now. But the sector that really hasn't made a move yet is midstream. I keep watching midstream, and you know, if you think you've missed out on the rally, there's been quite a rally in the you know, in the services and the oil companies. Midstream has not participated in that rally to any extent. So if you're looking for a bargain place to put your money, I'd say, you know, midstreams will eventually catch up. If oil prices hang in where they are, you know, the midstreams stand to, you know, make pretty good money, and yet they have lagged behind in the whole bull market that the oil market has seen in the last couple of months. But, you know, some of the companies I like, you know, small companies that are in the Permian Basin, like Diamondback, that's one of my favorites. EOG Resources, one of my favorites. ConocoPhillips, who I worked for years, that's also one that I like. They're a little bit more diversified. They probably won't see the sorts of returns in a bull market that a Diamondback will, but they're a little more diversified and probably a little less risky. And, you know, if oil prices go much higher, the refiners are the ones that you got to be careful of, because, you know, when oil prices are rising, their margins usually erode some. But, you know, the refiners have been the stars of the past 3 years. You know, when oil prices collapsed, you know, people think the whole energy sector collapsed, but refiners shined. I mean, they outperformed all of the broader market indices, and, you know, they were the only major sector of the energy sector, or say oil and gas, that had positive returns in the last 3 years.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. If our listeners would like to follow your work, how can they do so? I know you write for several publications and you have a newsletter, so tell us about it.
Right. So I write for Forbes. I write usually a weekly column there, and so you can find me there. But there's been a change since the last time I spoke with you. My Energy Strategist newsletter has been merged with Stephen Lieb. I don't know if you know Stephen. He's a best-selling author and has been advising investing for many, many years. He's on CNBC and the business news channels a lot. But we have a newsletter now called Real World Investing, and he's running the portfolio there. I continue to be, this is at Investing Daily, you know, I continue to be on the staff there, but I'm part of Real World Investing now, covering the energy sector. So that's the other place you can find me.
Well, life is complicated. Another week, another version of the GOP tax plan, this time coming from the Senate, on speculation that the Senate's version of the bill would postpone corporate tax cuts for a year. The Dow took a 250-point dive. So we need to look at the differences between the Senate and the House plans, and of course, what it all means to you and me as taxpayers and investors. And then risky business. Life is full of risk. There used to be a time, not too many years ago, when you could have safe investments, which would get you somewhere between 5 and 8%. But those times are long gone. The only place you can get any kind of high yields right now are in junk bonds. Is this a time to be worried? All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as part of the Financial Sense NewsHour at FinancialSense.com.